The Bleacher Report app is your destination for sports. Right now, the NBA is heating up, March Madness is here, and MLB is almost back. Every day there's a new headline, a new highlight, a new moment you've got to see for yourself. That's why I stay locked in with the Bleacher Report app. For me, it's about staying connected to my sports. I can follow the teams I care about, get real-time scores, breaking news, and highlights all in one place. Download the Bleacher Report app today so you never miss a moment.
Hello, listeners of The Tower, and welcome to my episode with the one and only Joe Lynch as we discuss his Tower film, Evil Dead 2. Joe is the phenomenal director known for such films as Wrong Turn 2, Mayhem, and the upcoming horror comedy, Buzzkill. And Joe is filled with knowledge that cannot be found on the internet, frankly. He has so much knowledge about Evil Dead 2, about Sam Raimi himself, personal interactions with Sam Raimi that Joe has had. And Joe just, he goes so deep into this film and really talks about how it's influenced his own filmmaking. It was such a fun, inspiring episode to record, and I'm pleased to offer that to you today. So please enjoy my conversation with Joe Lynch as we discuss Evil Dead 2. Today, welcome to The Tower, director, writer, cinematographer, all-around wonderful human being, Joe Lynch.
Hi, I'm way up here at The Tower. Hello, I'm saying hi to, I guess, everybody down there, or I guess you're at The Tower with me, right?
Yeah, we're dancing in the fire together.
Okay, perfect. Or I would rather be like in Bram Stoker's Dracula, where she's like at the top of the tower and just like falls over. You know, like I would love to be, you know, that version of the tower. But today I'm thrilled to be here with you, Emily. Long time no see. We saw each other last month in New York for an impromptu, recording session, which was amazing, by the way. Thank you so much for doing that.
Oh, my gosh. As an actor, I've wanted to be directed by you for forever. I've been a fan of your work. So it was absolutely my pleasure.
Wait, hold on. What's your Venmo?
My Venmo. Well, I'll message you.
Okay, good. I'm not good with compliments, so I feel like I have to put a monetary component to it. So, but thank you very much. I really appreciate that. And look, I've been following yours and Justin's work for years as well. Ever since my writing partner, now wife, Becca, kind of, you know, said you got to check those guys out, and so I've been a fan. So this is just going to be one long sloppy wet kiss of discussing, obviously, a movie that we both love, but admiration for each other's work as well.
Joe, thank you so much. Well, the admiration is hurled back at you from both myself and my husband, Justin. Let's segue into you, because I'm blushing too much over here. So to talk about your work, which we love, I mean, man, you have been doing this for so long. You got your start, I think, in music videos. Is that right?
I did. And, first off, when you say you've been doing this for so long, I'm not used to that paradigm or that kind of comparison. I'm still in the mindset that I'm the new kid on the block, the upstart, the underdog. You know, like when people go like, man, you've had a hell of a career. I'm like, but I've just gotten started. Wait, hold on. You know, like I haven't achieved all of my goals yet, you know, but that all started, and you're right, with music videos. I grew up in the 90s, where music videos seemed to be at that point a perfect kind of way station for, you know, budding directors, feature directors, to kind of cut their teeth on a format and a medium that's short form. They can test things out. They can kind of get their voice out in a way. And it was when they started crediting the directors too. So I was able to go like, oh, so that's what a David Fincher looks like. And that's what a Michael Bay music video looks like. Or that's Spike Jonze.
Jonathan Glazer.
Or Glazer, exactly. You know,
yeah.
Seeing all of his early UK work, it was so informative. And, you know, I was like, that's my route. Because I love music and I love visuals. And as a kid, I used to take two VCRs and put them together, like connect them together and make little music video kind of remixes of some of my favorite movies. And, you know, like I would take Tribe Called Quest and put it behind the, what is it? The scene from at the end of Mad Max Beyond Thunderdome, the big train scene. Or I would take Pantera and put it on, you know, the scene when Mel Gibson is yanking the poles from the Lethal Weapon 2 house. And I would show these to people and okay. you know, they would just be kind of like indifferent to it and shit. But that kind of got me really interested in the kind of the symbiosis between music or sound and visuals. And it just felt like a natural component for me to go like, I should do music videos. And I was doing them for like local bands for a while. And then the bottom dropped out of the music industry. And like this is the story of my fucking life, Emily. And I'm sure that like many people can relate. It's like, I just swoop in just on the cusp of the end of a trend. So music videos went from $1 million budgets. The first time I got like a big band, you know, music video, I'm like, all right, here we go. It's going to be Gravy Train on Biscuit Wheels. And they're like, oh, the $1 million that the band usually gets. No, they're getting, you know, 30,000. And I'm like, fuck me. God damn it. Can I curse?
Yeah.
Okay, cool. I just wanted to make sure. Or golly gee whiz for all of you kids out there.
Oh,
but
shucks.
it was a huge bummer. But
yeah,
and this all comes back to the movie that we're going to discuss. It forced me to have to be creative and resilient with the kind of scope that I was looking for, the kind of creativity that I was going for. It made me have to think outside the box, or just instead of know how like those, that was, and that's been in like a kind of mandate on any shoot that I've had. I even tell people up front when we're hiring people and stuff like that, I go, I do not want you to say no. I want you to say how can we figure this out? And I think it's that kind of indie spirit, or that do it yourself spirit, something that are, you know, the filmmakers that we're going to be talking to, you know, today, like, you know, Sam Raimi and Rob Tappert and Scott Spiegel, who we just lost a couple days ago. Mm-hmm. It was that kind of energy and that can do spirit that has been influencing me ever since that movie that we're going to talk about, and has kind of really filtered the way that I've kind of approached any project, big or small, even directly, as you saw last night when I sent you a music video based on the movie that we're talking about, that really got my start. That like that music video is the movie that got me Wrong Turn 2, or at least got me in the room to do Wrong Turn 2. And then the rest is history, to the point where, well, you know what? I'll save that story for later, because it ends with a really wonderful hug from one filmmaker to one filmmaker's hero. So I'll save that for dramatic effect.
Thank you so much for sending me that music video, Strapping Young Lad. The song is Love? ?
Yeah, absolutely. That was around the time that I was doing a lot of music videos for metal bands, bands that were on Metal Blade and Nuclear Blast and Century Media, some Roadrunner. Like, I was really into metal. I still am, you know, but I started a kind of a headbangers ball show for Fuse, which used to be Much Music, but the American component of that was called Fuse. And they had seen a pilot that I did for a new headbangers ball that MTV rejected, because at the time, this is 2001, they were like, no one's listening to metal right now. And I'm like, are you kidding? Okay, you know, like, sure. But then Fuse saw that and said, can you do this for us? But the only thing is, you have to shoot it, you have to edit it, and you have to use our secretary as the host. And it
so
was
back
a show.
On, back on your trend of being at the tail end of something that's getting funding, and then you're having to figure it out.
Exactly. Yep. Exactly. Yeah. And so that show became Uranium, and all these bands that I was meeting, I was being the shrewd businessman that I was trying to be, and going like, after we would interview, you know, Cold Chamber or Pantera or Danzig, well, that's a whole another story, Rob Zombie, Static X, like all these bands that I was meeting, I would go, hey, do you need a music video anytime soon? And be like, yeah, kid, whatever. And it wasn't until, myself, my brother, and my ex moved out to California in 2002, when kind of the bottom kind of dropped out of everything in New York production wise after 9/11. Mm-hmm. I was like, all right, let's go. Hey, I hear California, they make movies there. So we went out there, and I, like, on a whim, I had a little bit of money saved up from the show, and there was this camera, and I'm sure, like, you and especially Justin would appreciate this, but do you guys remember the DVX-100, the 24P camera that Panasonic put out years ago?
Definitely.
Okay. I was the first person in California to have that camera.
And oh my God.
I put myself on a wait list immediately when I heard, wait, 24P? Holy shit. You know, it's like this could change everything. And it did. And so I put myself on the waiting list. And 6 months after I got to LA, I got the camera. I worked so much as a DP off of this camera because everybody wanted their films to look like film. And this was in the DV era where, you know, you're shooting 30p and you're fucking, you know, the image up a little bit to make it look a semblance like film. But this was the first camera that I could do it in a prosumer way. And I was shooting music videos left and fucking right. It was awesome. And one of the companies that reached out, there was this band, Strapping Young Lad, who I knew of, you know, I was a fan of. And they said, we, you know, they really want to do kind of like a horror based music video. I'm like, you found the right guy. And in talking to the lead singer, you know, we were just kind of trading ideas back and forth. And that's when we both discovered, and not that this is like a obscure indie cult film, like, you know, like Haxan or, you know, like any of those kind of like weird deep dives. This was Evil Dead 2. And we both went, I love Evil Dead 2. I love Evil Dead 2 as well. And immediately I go, you know what? What if we put the band in the cabin from Evil Dead? And at the time, my ex was about like possibly working for Sam Raimi when he was doing Spider-Man 3. They were shooting Spider-Man 3 in the Sony lot. And she got like answered an ad that was saying, you know, big filmmaker looking for an assistant. It just so happened to be fucking Sam Raimi, which was mind blowing. We went to Sony and she didn't get the gig, but I met Sam for the first time there. And I don't know what it was. We hit it off. We exchanged email addresses. I don't know how the fuck that happened. But then when I had pitched to the band that I wanted to do, you know, an homage to Evil Dead 2, which is, look, is not the most original idea in the world, but this was my love letter to Sam and, you know, and to Evil Dead, and kind of pay back how much this movie changed my life, which we'll get to. So I was like, I'm pulling out all the stops, and I had this camera that could shoot, look, and make it look like film on a very small budget. So, you know, I was like, well, what do we need to really clinch that? So I first off, I got his permission to do an homage. I wanted to make sure that he knew that I wasn't trying to just rip him off. And then I was like, and if anybody who's listening to this knows that, you know, in every one of Sam's movies, he's got his car from back in the day, the old Cutlass, that, you know, which he dubbed the classic. That yellow Caprice has been in every single movie that he's done. So it was like, This is what's gonna kill it, and it's gonna make all the horror fans freak out. I'm gonna get the classic. I'm gonna put it in the video. So I don't know where my balls came from for this, but I emailed him and said, "Hey, listen, hey buddy, how's it going? You know, like, any chance that I could possibly borrow the car? Classic?"
Oh my God.
He wrote me back immediately and said, "Hey, buddy, how's it going?" He doesn't sound like a Canadian in South Park, but yeah, actually he does. He's like, "Hey, buddy, how's it going? You know, sadly, the classic's on all these stilts and all these wires at Sony Pictures to do Spider-Man 3. So unfortunately, you can't use the car, but you have my blessing." And that's all I really needed. So therefore, I went out and we made this video for, you know, at the time, which was nothing, which was 10 grand, which mostly went to getting the band from Canada to LA to shoot on. If you ever watched the video, we shot on the set for Roseanne. The living room for Roseanne is our cabin.
No way.
This is the sort of like Easter egg shit that I just love talking about because it's like the geeky shit that maybe four people appreciate. But we shot that video and, you know, we did it for like no money, no time. And I cut it, put it out there, you know. And if you're a metal fan and you're a filmmaker, one of the biggest honors that you could have is to have one of your videos premiere on the Headbangers Ball, which was still, which ironically happened because our show Uranium was a huge hit on Fuse, and therefore MTV brought back Headbangers Ball. So in this weird sort of way, like I was able to regenerate Headbangers Ball specifically so that I can have one of my videos on the air. And it aired and it had my name on it. And I swear to God, Emily, I was like, bucket list checked. I've been able to homage one of my favorite movies of all time, give this like love letter back to it in a small kind of bite-sized sort of way. And it aired on the show that I was obsessed with in the 80s and 90s. So I felt done. It's a win. And then 6 weeks later, no, not even. It was like a month later, I get a call from my friend who turned into manager, who has now moved on to become Ed Berger's producer, Luke Rivett. He said that someone at Fox had seen that video and went, "Hey, that guy seems to know about horror movies." Wrote my name down because they saw the credit, and I was the 11th person on the list of 10 people that they were considering for Wrong Turn 2. So if it wasn't for that video, I would have never been on that list, and I would have never made Wrong Turn 2, and we would have likely not been talking today.
Joe, I love that story so much, and it ties it in so perfectly with your Tower film today, Evil Dead 2. I mean, honestly, just growing up in the 90s, having two VCRs, the tactile, just make it happen nature of you loving films growing up, finding this band and music video, talking to Sam Raimi, getting the classic in the video, like that is balls to email Sam Raimi and be like, "Dude, can I borrow your car?" And then to lead into your first feature film debut, I mean, it's really heartwarming. Like as such a metal and horror fan, that's like a Cinderella story, honestly.
It is. You know, I look back at it, and that's why, like, when you reached out and said, you know, what are your Tower movies? Yeah. And, you know, there's always a tendency to find, you know, that deeper cut that someone goes like, "Oh, I didn't know that you were so influenced by this obscure Russian 1922 film." You know, like, sure. But, you know, as fans, as, you know, I'm sure you've gotten in the last couple of years too, you know, fans want to know what drives us as storytellers, what inspires us, what ignites that fire underneath us. Yeah. And, you know, I love being able to recommend movies. You know, my wife and I, you know, when we started this show a couple months ago that we're kicking into gear again called A Couple Old Fashions, you know, like part of the reason why we do it is because we go, you know, we don't go out much, but when we do, all we do is talk about movies. And a lot of times it's usually like, "You haven't seen this," and not in a disparaging way. Like I always say it, like, you're lucky. You get to see, you know, Dawn of the Dead for the first time when I saw it when I was 3 and I was way too young. You know, like you're to be able to pass along the good word of cinema is one of the best parts about being in cinema. And, you know, now that both of us, you and I, have been kind of put on this somewhat higher plateau of being able to profess our love for certain films and people listen, that's so exciting. But to go back and, you know, and think about like, what are the movies that influenced me? Like originally I was going to pick my usual chestnut, which is Chuck Russell's the Blob remake, which came out in 1988. That is the movie. And I've said this many times before, so sorry to anyone who's heard this ad nauseum, but you know, August 6th, 3:10 show, Brookhaven Multiplex on Long Island August 6, 1988. That was the screening that my mom took my brothers and I to go see Chuck Russell's The Blob. And I was already a huge, you know, fan of his from Nightmare on Elm Street 3 and everything. But this was like, holy shit. Like I was really excited. And that screening was the moment when I went, "Oh, wait. So that's what a director does. He's not only, you know, sticking his hand out and pointing like next to the camera and shit like that with a beard and dark sunglasses and a hat. Like he's got a hand in the writing and, you know, he's working with the cinematographer, or, you know, cinematographer, or she's working with the editor and, you know, working with the cast." And it felt like here's the perfect job for me because I was interested in all of it. And I didn't want to just relegate myself to either acting or makeup effects. I just basically wanted to be Tom Savini back in the day. But The Blob was one of those movies that kind of flipped a switch in me. But
yeah,
not even that film changed the way I looked at life, the way that Evil Dead 2 did. And that is not hyperbolic. Like I you can just rev me up as you've already heard, but like I can specifically, watching it again last night, it stoked so many flames of where I was. Like, to me, there is the Joe before Evil Dead 2, and then there's the Joe after Evil Dead 2. So like that's why I was like, even though this might not be a deep cut or, you know, might be a little bit on the obvious side, Evil Dead 2 was so formidable to me that I have no problem talking about it until the cows come home.
That's so heartwarming. And honestly, I love it when people don't overthink and don't second guess their instinct as far as their Tower films, because it's important. And the way it's important to you is specific to you. And so it becomes fresh for me to rewatch too, because even rewatching it now that I know you and I know your work and I know Becca, it's such a fuller experience revisiting this film, which I've seen countless times. Mm-hmm. But just, you know, when you're watching your own film with an audience, you're watching it differently. Taking in the energy. And it was almost as if I was like sitting next to you being like, oh yeah, Joe loves this. Like this I've seen in his work. So it was, this was a pleasure for me revisiting, just understanding your love for it. So, as we dive in, as we've already said, we're talking about Evil Dead 2, 1987. And for anyone who hasn't seen the film, I'm just going to read the log line very quickly, directed by Sam Raimi. Ash Williams, the lone survivor of an earlier onslaught of flesh possessing spirits, holes up in a cabin with a group of strangers while demons continue their attack.
Sold. I'm in.
Sold. I mean, but that logline doesn't even begin to dive into the madness and the slapstick and the just guts and gore and green and red and black goo.
Every single body. I didn't even know what bile was. Until I kept reading about it in Fangoria, when they would be like, we have blood, we have bile. I'm like, what the fuck is bile? And when you see the movie, there's only really two prevalent like body fluid colors that you see. You obviously see red, but then you see black. And I'm like, that's what bile is? And it wasn't until years later when I actually like threw up and someone's like, oh man, all you got left is bile. And it's like yellow. I'm like, that's not black. Oh God, what's wrong with me? Like my idea of what biology is was affected by Evil Dead 2. You're totally right, Emily, in terms of that only scratches the surface, because Evil Dead 2, if many who haven't seen the original don't know, is almost like a do-over. It's like for Sam and for Rob and for all and Bruce and all the people who made the original Evil Dead, which was so notorious that, you know, it was banned in England when it first came out. And you look at it now and it's like tame in comparison. But it's all about how they kind of rewrote the route. They got another chance to take audiences on an experiential ride. You know, this movie, when you go back and watch it again, it is all about the journey. It is not about the, even though the destination is so, like, no one who's ever seen this movie for the first time would ever go, hey, I know how this movie's going to end. You know, like, there's no fucking way. There's absolutely no way that anyone could predict where that's going to go, which is great. I love stories like that, that, you know, you know, Tarantino talked about this like a couple, I think like last year, where he was like, you know, we're in a rut with cinema right now, because a lot of the stories aren't stories. They're situationals. You know, they are easily set up and they're easily executed, and you can pretty much go in knowing how it's going to end, but it's not a full-blooded story. Whereas Evil Dead 2, yes, it's two lovers, you know, who clearly someone didn't realize the last time that they went. It's almost like Raimi kind of retconned the first movie to allow, you know, less people in the house, but allow more shenanigans and more hijinks to happen when you know, Ash and his girlfriend get to the cabin. And from there, it is purely a feast of the senses, because he uses every single trick in the book. And I've even like read and heard people talk about how all of this is in Ash's head. You know, there are no ghosts, there are no demons, there are no deadites. That sure. this is the testament of a man who's dealing with loss, who might have killed his girlfriend, going through all of the stages of trauma and madness, dealing with the fact that, right? Like, and I love the fact that people can go back and watch the movie purely in that way. Now, I think Sam would be the first person to be like, yeah, buddy, that's exactly not what I was going for.
Right.
But that's the beauty of cinema, is that everyone brings so many different things to the table subjectively, that if someone wanted to walk in and watch this as a treatise on trauma, you know, go for it. You know, like, if anything, don't say that that's, you know, you're wrong, because who's to say you are? You know, it's the same way as someone saying this movie sucks. It's like, well, that's you. You know, that's the baggage that you're bringing to the table. Me, and I'm sure many other people, find this movie a classic and something that completely changed the game. I wanted to ask you, because, you know, as a filmmaker, as a fellow filmmaker, you saw Evil Dead 2 before you started making movies, correct?
I did. Yeah.
Okay. Now, I have had an evolution of Evil Dead 2. And I think everybody who has ever gotten behind the camera or made a particular shot or, you know, made a particular cut in a film and crafted something, you know, from A to B to C, if you are an Evil Dead 2 fan, I think that you have a wildly new appreciation and resonance for Evil Dead 2 once you make a movie. The moment that I saw the movie, it was playing at one movie theater in Long Island. And my dad, who was he customized cars in Long Island. So he was kind of like a fashion designer for cars. Mm-hmm. And we were going to a car show. We were coming home from a car show at the Nassau Coliseum. It was around April of 87. And we, you know, and look, at that point, I was reading Fangoria like it was the fucking Bible, right? Yeah. So of course I knew what Evil Dead 2 was, and I was hotly anticipating it, but I couldn't go into the city to go see it. No one was going to take me. As much as my mom is a huge horror fan, she was just like, Joey, you're on your own on that one. Right. So I had to wait for home video, but there was one theater playing it, and I literally told my dad, stop the car! When we drove past this one theater playing Evil Dead 2. And yeah. I begged him to let me see it. And unfortunately, he's like, no, I can't do that. So we drove off, and man, I was devastated. I was like, this is the only chance I'm ever going to see that movie. Thankfully, like 6 or 8 months later, it finally came out on, I think it was on Vestron home video, and then watched the movie. And it honestly changed the way I looked at life. And again, not being hyperbolic, because when you watch Evil Dead 2 and Evil Dead 1 to a degree, but I think Evil Dead 2 is kind of like where Evil Dead 1 was a rough draft and Evil Dead 2 was Sam's way of refining that draft finally on Dino De Laurentiis's dime. And yeah. All of the cool stuff that he was trying to do in the first one, really shaggy, you know, work, but it was still there. And then when he hired one of the best DPs in genre ever, Peter Deming, who ended up going on doing, you know, Lost Highway and Scream 2, actually Scream 1 as well, when he got rehired, Austin Powers, like he was a powerhouse. But back then, you know, he was a up and coming DP. But I think that symbiosis between what Sam was going for with all these cool little gimmicky tricks of like, you know, the Snorri cam and the Deadeye cam going through, you know, put the camera on a block of wood and run it through, you know, the water or going through windows. That kind of extreme subjectivity type camera, I had never seen something like that before. Maybe the only other movie at that time that was that expressive was Raising Arizona. Fun fact, totally. Did you know that Raising Arizona and Evil Dead came out on the same exact day in 1987?
I know that Raimi was very close with the Coen brothers, but no, I did not know that piece.
Could you imagine? Because Raimi and the Coens worked together, or at least Joel worked with Raimi on the first Evil Dead. And then Raimi ended up helping Joel and Ethan out doing the promo for Blood Simple. So they had already been, you know, besties for a while, but just so funny that both of them kind of branched out and did bigger movies. You know, Evil Dead 2 and Raising Arizona were ostensibly like much bigger affairs than their first films. And they came out the same day and they both bombed, and both are considered classics today. But other than Sonnenfeld was doing with Raising Arizona, with this very almost cartoonish camera, Raimi refined and if anything, pushed the limits to what he was doing, both with the camera work, but also with the editing. And I let's be honest. How many times have you seen a snap zoom montage of someone grabbing a gun, loading it, you know, like putting anything down, you know, on anything or prepping anything, and not think of those montages that Raimi did when he was, you know, when Ash was putting together the chainsaw? That language changed the way that I looked at life. So to this day, anytime that I make a bowl of cereal, for example, I close one eye and I move my head to grab the cereal, pour the cereal in, pour the milk in, grab your spoon, you know, like overhead shot of the cabinet opening up to see the spoon, grab the spoon in the whip pan, snap zoom. Yeah. I do this every single day because of Evil Dead 2. It changed the way I looked at the world. And that's really why, like, I picked this movie, because, you know, one of the joys of being able to watch movies, whether you're a casual fan or, you know, a budding filmmaker or even a filmmaker now. And that's why I brought that up about, like, before about the, you know, if you watch Evil Dead 2 before you step behind a camera, you have an appreciation for it from on a subjective level that makes you go like, wow, that's so cool. And oh, that's a really cool gag. Once you make a movie, especially like for me with Wrong Turn 2, there's a lot of splatter homages. When I approached Wrong Turn 2, when I got the job, I went in there and said, look, I don't want to make the Texas Chainsaw Massacre like the first movie. I want to make Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2, because that was a splatter movie that knew the rules between having horror and a sense of humor. And Evil Dead 2, I think, was the pinnacle of that time. So once you watch it after you've made a movie, and I remember doing this too, like I remember watching Evil Dead 2 after I'd finished and delivered Wrong Turn 2, I watched it again and I saw that movie completely different, because now you know how the sausage is made. Now you know what it's like to make a day or not make a day, or know that like that one fucking camera shot that you've had in your head for, you know, since you wrote the script or came up with the idea or read the script and went, oh man, I could totally have this camera go through someone's eyeball and out their asshole. Like when you realize then, oh shit, you know what? It's not as easy as it sounds, you know, like, our ambitions become real, and it only makes you appreciate all the hell that they went to in making Evil Dead 2 even more, because now you know what it was like to be on that set and have to craft something, you know, that is telling the story visually. When you would see it in a video store, it had a big disclaimer on it saying like, this movie will fuck you up. Right. And it did. I don't think anyone would have expected the amount of humor and comedy in Evil Dead 2 based on any reaction that they might have had in the, you know, from the first one. If Stephen King is calling this movie ferocious, then I'm a little afraid of this, you know, possibly dangerous film. So you go into the new one and you go like, okay, I'm going to get my fucking senses raped. And then you go, but wait a second, this is kind of funny. And then next thing you know, you're laughing just as much as you're screaming. And that's all attributed to the fact that Sam was zigging instead of zagging.
Just diving into broad strokes of what the film even is. In the first 5 minutes, we are introduced to Ash and Linda in the car. We've seen that in the first one. Lovers going to a cabin. There's very little dialogue. But this is a normal film that seems to be setting up. We know this film. It's a situation, like you said earlier in the podcast. Like, this is a situation that we all know, and we probably know how this is going to happen. Except by minute six, she is possessed. And by minute 10, she has been decapitated by her lover. And we're not even 10 minutes into the film yet. And from that point, the film almost becomes a silent film of a comedy of errors and blood. And it just becomes it at different times. This film, once Linda is dead, you get stop motion animation. I am reminded of Peter Gabriel's video,
Sledgehammer,
like back in the day, like when Ash is hurtling through the forest backwards after he's been possessed, and then it's dawn. Honestly, it is so slapstick, and I feel so whiplash, just pure whiplash, because of the camera work and because of the plot twists that are constantly wrong footing me. This film does not take a breath. And I think
you know what's funny though?
It
actually does take a breath, but that becomes a gag. You know, like you just mentioned that sequence where, you know, they basically remake Evil Dead 1 in the first 10 minutes.
Exactly.
Everything from they arrive, they see the creepy cabin. You know, one of them gets attacked by something that breaks through a window.
Yeah.
That person gets killed. They get buried. Then Ash leaves, tries to leave, comes back and everything. And then, you know, the deadites, you know, start to kind of inflict their mental, emotional, and physical damage on Ash continuously. But that moment that you were talking about where it's spinning around and it looks like he's going 200 miles an hour, and then he, you know, falls into the puddle. He comes out as a deadite created by Mark Shostrom, who also did Phantasm 2 and got KMB their start. And then when he changes back, you have that shot where the camera becomes his point of view and does a 360 degree like a scan of the place and then comes back to him.
Yeah.
That's one of the few times that it ever stays silent. But it's every time I've seen it in the theater, people laugh their asses off because of that. Because now the language has been created by the filmmakers that this is going to be manic, but the filmmakers are also smart enough to know, give the audience a contemplative breath and then rip the carpet out from underneath them. So like even a moment that could be considered slow, I wouldn't be surprised if Dino De Laurentiis, he's the one who produced the movie, would have said like, no, you cannot have this cold moment. You have to, you know, like put some music in. There's no music. It's just atmosphere. But by allowing that to happen, it feels like Sam, who I think like at this point was a savant in terms of manipulating the audience. Like he had already gotten a taste of what that was like with the first one and kind of got burned on Crime Wave because of, you know, all the shenanigans that was happening after that. And very much like, not to relate it to my own work, but I see it, you know, with Evil Dead 2, this was an angry young man going, you know what? Hold my fucking beer. Hold my bucket of blood. I'm going to show you what I'm all about. I had the same thing happen to me. Literally, like I've had the same parallel, maybe not the same career and financial gains as Sam has had, but like I look at Wrong Turn 2 as my Evil Dead, right?
Yeah.
Then I did a movie called Knights of Badassdom. That was my second film. But that film was a disaster in terms of making it. It was a Ponzi scheme. It was marred by really, really bad producing. I'll be the first person to take a lot of the blame for, you know, maybe being too ambitious. But it drove me crazy, like to the point where I had an antidepressant in, you know, that little pocket that you have in your jeans where you go like, what is that used for? Yeah. I would have medication in my pocket and I would rub it all day to kind of remind myself that if I need this medication to zone me out because of all the stress that I'm going through, trying to make this mountain of a movie happen and finding out later that I got totally fucked. It was a nightmare. So when I made the movie Everly, the Salma Hayek movie, that's essentially my remake of Evil Dead 2. Because if you think about it, it's one person in one space, all of these foreign entities, you know, and that they have, you know, in Evil Dead 2, it's the Deadites, and in here it's Yakuza members. And, you know, the whole film pretty much takes place in one space. But I look at that movie as an angry, angry filmmaker who felt like they got totally fucked and put in a box. And here's my way of breaking out of that box. Evil Dead 2 to me feels like Sam is kind of declaring to the world, I'm bigger than this box and I'm going to break out of it. So much so that he does it by the end of the film. He completely makes another movie. So it's almost like he's it felt like now I can look back at that movie reflectively and say, this was Sam's way of announcing to the industry, to the audience, to the world that I'm better than this cabin. I'm bigger than this cabin.
This is such a great tower film once again, just because it does burn down every preconception. You can read the log line, you can see the poster and read quotes. It doesn't prepare you at all for the human being at the center of this. So many directors that they're skilled with their camera. They have beautiful composition and their treatment of cinematography is really specific. But Rainey's, the camera is him, and it's just hurtling through the world, through time, of saying, this is my story, and I am going to be holding your hand and like plummeting through this forest with you the entire time. Obviously, he's using inspiration like the Three Stooges, which he has pointed to time and time again. He wanted to make a film that was like a Three Stooges film, but if they poked each other in the eye, what if it hurt? What if it drew blood? That's something he said before. So he takes that, but again, the camera placement and the sound design of this film, at different points, we've got monkeys yelling while a transformation is happening. There are no rules.
There's a locomotion. There's a locomotion like sound effect at one point when they are watching, and this was so genius because, like, obviously we look back at this movie and go, perfect, don't change a thing. I still wouldn't be surprised if Sam could go back and go, I really wanted to show those Deadites, like, you know, going from one end of the room or the living room to the other, and they couldn't. So what did they do? They just honed the camera on the cast and had them go, look, look there, look there, look there, look up there, look down there. And by putting in those sound effects and adding those kind of like tilted image lens shots where it's like they're skewing the camera like a little, or the lens a little bit, so it looks like it's warped and stretched and stuff. Yeah. By doing that, it added this surrealist quality that only immerses you even deeper into, like, whoever made this, you can't not watch this and go, like, at that time, whatever was going through Sam's head, he put everything on screen. Yeah. You know, as kooky and as absurdist as possible, it felt like there was no tourniquet in terms of what could be thrown in there. It's a kitchen sink movie, you know, like from the plot to the dialogue to the, you know, extremities of the gore to the camera work to the editing. And you're right, the sound design is so much an integral part of the movie. And again, I would have never thought of sound design in making a movie until I saw this and saw, like, he's literally the guy from Christopher Guest in Spinal Tap, where he's like, this goes to 11. Like, the whole movie is turned to 11, and you can't appreciate it from an audience or a filmmaker standpoint. Some of the things that might be considered a little bit more subtle in this, like in the process of visual storytelling, like sound design, you know, not many films can be as expressive as what Evil Dead 2 allowed Sam and his sound designers to be. You know, like you can get away with, you know, monkey noises and animal, you know, farm noises and, you know, speeding train noises and stuff like that, because he sets up from that first 10 minutes that all bets are off. And that's something that you have to, as a filmmaker, as a storyteller, you kind of have to know from the jump that unless you are deliberately saving all the madness for the end, yeah, then you have to be tonally somewhat consistent, or at least set that up that we're going to, like, few films, you know, like Audition, for example, you would never watch that movie and go, oh, I know exactly where this is going.
No.
If anything, you know, Takashi Miike is saying, like, oh no, imagine if you're watching Pretty Woman and then I grab the remote and turn it, and now you're watching Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Exactly. You know,
that's almost like a sadistic point of view. Yeah. If Sam had not set up, all, like, again, like a somewhat remake of Evil Dead 1 in the first 10 minutes, yeah, I think the audience would have, it would have been more jarring for the audience to kind of start getting into that more splat sticky kind of those kind of histrionics from both a visual standpoint and a sound standpoint. Have you ever watched a movie where all of a sudden a fucking weird, crazy shot happens and you go, that felt awkward? I think that's partially due to, and I'm not going to name any film or any filmmakers, but, you know, it feels like sometimes you can tell the filmmaker is being a somewhat irresponsible with how they're keeping the trajectory of a film from point A to point Z in check, you know? And look, I can appreciate a flying eyeball shot like anybody else, but if you don't have it set up in the beginning that we might see one of these shots, it's going to stick out like a sore thumb.
Yeah. No, you're exactly right. It's setting up those expectations. And I mean, to bring up Takashi Miike's Audition, he does that, you're right, in a sadistic way. But even to go back to the expectations of this film, you're right. We set up a familiar story and use that as a jumping off point to go completely bonkers. And honestly, the sound design that we're talking about is also used in more quote-unquote serious horror films as well, like The Exorcist, which came out, you know, not quite 10 years prior to this. Famously, he used the sound of bees, you know, in the background. And Friedkin used like a growling lion when we would see these dream sequences in order to kind of stoke unease in the audience. And here, Sam Raimi uses everything at his disposal so that he can really just hurdle us into his specific world. And it's a matter of understanding who he is specifically. He might be referencing things that he likes. There are tones of The Wizard of Oz and Three Stooges in here. And obviously, like, tons of horror references as well, but this is a human being who understands himself and understands the story that he wants to convey. And that's why it's so thrilling. It's because he's taking himself seriously in order to make a ridiculous ride for us. And I think that is the beauty of being selfish and in tune with yourself as a director, because once you fully understand the story you want to tell and how you want to tell it, it becomes the least selfish act ever, because it allows people into your point of view. And I think that is such a wonderful gift of cinema. That's what I love the most.
Absolutely. When you can look at the full Sam Raimi bodice of work, right? Yeah. Like his entirety of work up to this point, you know, he could have used those same kind of flourishes in a movie like A Simple Plan, yet he knew that, look, the biggest special effect in that movie is the humanity of these two brothers played by Bill Paxton and Billy Bob Thornton. Mm. And his kind of stylistic predilections would have gotten in the way. Yeah. So, like, you and I guarantee that anybody who saw Evil Dead 2 when it came out, and then if you look at the next few films that he had done, and I'm guilty of this as well, But I think that they're like our expectations of what he could do with a superhero movie or a medieval adventure film, later on with a, you know, superhero movie like Spider-Man. I think we were all like, in a weird sort of way, there, I wouldn't be surprised if many of us were just slightly disappointed because it wasn't as wild and crazy as Evil Dead 2 was. But that's because the story is, and this is where it goes back to, you know, that one theory that all of this could have been in his head. This whole movie is technically all Sam Raimi's head. So this is his version of what the story could be. Now, one of the cool things about this in reflection is that you can take the remake, you know, Fede Alvarez's remake of Evil Dead.
Yeah.
And Fede wasn't trying to emulate what was in Sam's head, because you know what? Fede Alvarez is not Sam Raimi. And right. I don't mean that in any disparaging way. I mean it like, here's another filmmaker who was confident enough to not give us the snap zoom montages and the splatstick kind of humor that for all intents and purposes, you know, Evil Dead 2 is the apex of that series, because that's what we remember more than the first one being a scrappy, rough draft, and Army of Darkness being a weird, you know, swerve into a whole nother movie genre, just using it happened to have the same characters. Evil Dead, the remake, is in the head of this drug addict. And if you try to make a splatstick version of that, tonally would be the biggest fucking mistake. But yeah. Fede knew that he had to, because of the subject matter, he had to go darker. And that's the version that we got. And look, the first time I saw that movie, I went in with my fucking arms folded, because I was like, I didn't get the gig. Because I went in and pitched on it. And I'm like, well, fuck this guy. He just walks in with his short film and he gets the job. I can name on at least two hands, maybe toes, how many times that's happened to me, where I go in guns blazing and then you hear, oh yeah, this guy who came in after you, this girl came in after you, just went in for a general and they said, would you like to do this movie? And I'm like, you son of a bitch, you know? And maybe that's a testament to how bad my pitch was, or maybe it's just like shitty luck. But you know when you're in good hands with a filmmaker, when they're so, you're right, they're so self-confident that they're almost selfish with their way of telling the story, but it's also the restraint that he didn't keep making Evil Dead 2 with the same energy that he did with The Gift or A Simple Plan or even for The Love of the Game or any of those movies. Like, and he could have satisfied a small contingent of movie nerds that have been like, oh my God, we got the shot of, a baseball flying through the air just the way he did the eyeball in Evil Dead 2.
Right.
There's always going to be someone who's always going to be like, man, I really wish he could do, Evil Dead 2 again. And he did in a way with Drag Me to Hell, but he made it like more commercial and more PG-13. But at the same time, Evil Dead 2 will always be there, and for as many... Yeah. versions that we get here on out, there's two new ones coming out, and I'm excited about seeing what other filmmakers like Fede did, or what the director of Evil Dead Rise was able to do with like that version of it. I love that he's kind of passed the baton onto all these other filmmakers to give us their impression of it. What makes me the most excited is that, like, no matter what, and that's thanks to the fans, myself and yourself and Justin and everybody else included, the fact that we've had such love for this movie, and it just because it's not too mean and malicious, it's just mean enough. It's funny as hell that you can be a 12-year-old kid and still find it like incredibly funny without having to worry about all the gore. Yeah. And we've all been inspired by it so much that it has warranted us to have a Laserdisc, a DVD, another DVD, another DVD after that, a 4K, a Blu-ray, another Blu-ray, some format that's probably coming out next month. We do too. Do you have the one that's the Necronomicon itself?
Justin does, I believe.
Okay. Did you, and you'll have to ask him on my behalf, but Do you remember when that came out and they were like, if you put it in the freezer and pull it out again, it feels like real flesh?
No, I did not know that.
Yes, they actually advertised that as, if you put it in the freezer, it'll feel like dead flesh. Well, I did it and I left it in there too long and my disc fucking cracked.
So
food for thought, kids, don't do that. But the fact that they like, we've been lucky enough where all these different formats have allowed us to keep this movie alive. And smartly, they, you know, I think one of the best things that Sam and company could have done for Evil Dead 2 was to hire someone like Peter Deming to shoot the movie in a way that, you know, like watching it last night on 4K. You know, the movie still has that kind of scrappy spirit, but it has never aged itself out of being relevant because the camera shots still feel fresh. The approach that they take in both the camera work, the editing, the sound design, it never feels dated. The only thing that dates the movie, to be honest, is what's her name's sweater and maybe the classic, but other than that, It doesn't feel like an 80s movie. It could be like a 90s movie. It could be a movie that was shot yesterday, if you will. But some movies don't benefit from the 4K or the Blu-ray treatment. Like you take the grain out or, you know, certain effects get cleaned up. I like how scrappy all the effects are that you can kind of see the seams a little bit. And like you said before, like all the stop motion stuff, like, of course, that would be done CG today. You know, and which kills me because there's a tactile kind of like appreciation for like some dude had to sit there for days animating that fucking hand or animating the book. You know, I got a little taste of that when I was to bring it all back around again to the Strapping Young Lad video. I was like, how am I going to make the camera guy's hand go, you know, turn bad basically? And again, like this was something that I remember seeing in, I think it was in Army of Darkness, when they show Ash's hand in the beginning when they're doing the recap, like the previously on, and they show Ash's hand come up, and I'm like, that looks like someone just drew a Sharpie on a hand and just did it in a really crude stop motion sort of way. So we broke for lunch and I said to the guitar guy, I'm like, I need you to stay back and I'll go get your lunch, but can you just give me your hand for 45 minutes? And he's like, what are you talking about? That sounds weird. I'm like, no, I'm not going to jerk you off. I know that's what you're used to on tour. This is something different. And I sat there for 45 minutes. No, it was an hour because we went over on lunch because I had to do this. I put the guy's hand on an Apple box, made it stay very still. And then I drew the fucking veins that come out on his hand on with a Sharpie. And
it's great.
I would have never thought to do that if it wasn't for Sam Raimi going, you know what, buddy, you can do it like this. And whether it was in a BTS thing or even when you just watch it, anytime that you watch a movie now, the fun of effects has diminished, at least for me. I'm just speaking for myself here. When you go, oh, that was probably done on DaVinci, or it was probably done in After Effects, it was probably done with this program or that program, or there was probably a lot of render time that went into it. Like, it kind of goes over our heads unless you're a tech bro or bra, right?
Yeah.
Whereas with something like Evil Dead 2, where they're using practical effects, rear projection, stop motion, like every trick in the book is used in that. And you can watch the movie and you can't not watch it and go, how did they do that? But there's a little bit of it where you go, I could do that at home. I could totally get away with doing that with scotch tape and, you know, my neighbor's dog, you know, like to strap a camera on there. There was something about it that made it feel like it was that dream of being able to make something wild and crazy like that was attainable.
No, that's the part that welcomes you in. I remember growing up, I grew up in the 90s. I remember kind of in the late 90s when I was really like watching Nickelodeon a lot after school.
Oh, yeah.
There was a program or kind of an afternoon special run by this character called Stick Stickley, if you remember him.
No,
Yeah, he's literally a popsicle stick with googly eyes and like a face. And he would be like, hello, I'm... And you were able to like send in tapes to say, hi, stick, I'm from blah, 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 you know, California. And just kids could send in VHS. And I was like, one day, and this is before Evil Dead 2, before any of this, but I realized with my dad's massive camcorder, I could do stop motion animation if I... played it, if I recorded and then stopped and then like moved a thing. And I discovered I could actually make my Super Nintendo cord look like a snake, like it was like it was going across the couch. So dorky Emily Bennett from Charleston, South Carolina was like, hi, Stick, I'm blah, blah, blah. And let's see if my pet cord likes Nickelodeon as much as me. And I made it kind of like snake across the couch and it picked up the remote and it changed the channel to Nickelodeon. And I was like, oh, wow. And so I sent it in. And he played it. It was the best day of my life. Like a couple months later, you've never seen a happier, dorky redhead girl jumping around. But the
there's nothing
that he,
better.
Oh my
there's
God.
Nothing better than that feeling.
It's insane. That is probably the best day of my life, aside from my wedding day with Justin. Like those are the two best days of my life, I think. And I honestly, but I held on to that because that's something I discovered, because that was something a child could figure out. You're like, okay, it's just a bunch of pictures. And if it's like a flip book, you know, and if I film it this way, it can look like it's moving. When I encountered Peter Gabriel's Sledgehammer, you know, just all of the wonderful stop motion works, you start to discover like, I'm kind of part of that. I could do that too. And you feel so invited into this world. And when you see Sam Raimi's work in Evil Dead 2, it all feels so wild, so unpredictable, but so inviting. Attainable. Yep. And he gives you permission of saying, you can still be that kid and you can still figure this out with me. Let's go film let's go figure this out together. You can do it too. It almost feels like permission into the industry, I guess.
Think about how many filmmakers were influenced specifically by Evil Dead 2.
Yeah.
You know, like the list is way too long for people to, you know, to sit here and listen to us talk about it. And there would be even some filmmakers who wouldn't even say like it was Evil Dead 2, but it just got ingrained in their DNA. And you're right. Like there, I think it was the youthful spirit that Sam and Tom and Rob and all those guys that they had, the scrappy charm of the story itself, because it's a very simple story. But you're right. Like I will never forget the day that I think it was in high school where I tried out the Deadite cam where it was, I'm trying to remember, it was a high eight camera. It wasn't a VHS camera. It was a high eight camera. But even when that VHS camera, it had the handle at the top. Or remember the Canon XL1? That also had the handle at the top, which meant that you could run through your house with the camera low to the ground and make it seem like a Deadite. And, you know, I even did this in the Strapping on That Lad video where I was manning the camera where it was like running through the woods and spinning around and everything. I had to cut out me going, oh, you start doing the Deadite sound effect. But
sure.
But there was nothing better than to go upstairs to my room or, you know, like show my friends or whatever and show them how I was able to mimic something that Evil Dead 2 did. The snap zoom, like the day that I figured out that your camera had like a zoom that you could loosen up with that little screw at the top. Because before it was always like, I think every camera that I ever owned that had a zoom on it, I would deliberately grab it and try to start doing snap zooms. And I'm like, why is it so stuck? Fuck, it's too slow. Or you're trying to do it with the buttons and you're like, that's not how it's done.
Right.
But when you can figure out like, oh, wait a second. If I unscrew this, I can actually make it snap zoom. And the day that you can go like, I can do this shot from Evil Dead 2 and that shot from Evil Dead 2. Once you achieve that, then you like your filmmaking acumen changes and evolves because now you're going, well, instead of a snap zoom, what if I did it like this? And then you start to branch out, no pun, because of Evil Dead 2's tree stuff, but you start to be able to branch out from the techniques that you were just trying to rip off or emulate. And then you start to create your own voice. Yeah. So like, I look at all of the movies that I had done. Evil, like Wrong Turn 2 is, aside from Strapping Young Lad video, I think if I had not done that Strapping Young Lad video, yes, I would have never gotten in the room. But I also feel like I got to exercise all of these demons that I had inside of me in terms of, I really want to, you know, like emulate this. I really want to do that Raimi shot, that Raimi shot, that Raimi. And once I did it and I saw I could do it, it made me go, now what can I do different? Like, yeah. what can I do with this camera that maybe Sam couldn't do, or maybe like I'm going to zig when he zagged, you know? And that's where you start to create your voice. And, you know, and that's why, like, you know, I like watching Evil Dead 2 last night. It was so funny going, I did that shot before, did that shot before. Yep. Did that shot before. And then it branched out to, that shot I did in Mayhem. That was me going, well, I can't do it like this because I did it already in one other movie. And if you look back at the timeline of inspiration, it came from Evil Dead or Evil Dead 2. And now, like, how did I, and that's really what, like, that's the best way to kind of cultivate your voice, is to know that you can do it. Prove, even if it's just to yourself, that kind of euphoria that happens when you put two shots together, or a performance and a camera, you know, works in symbiosis. When you achieve that, then you start to get antsy on, well, how can I push that further? Hopefully. Or how can I get that again, but do it in a way that feels a little fresher than the last time? And that's where it all roots back to Evil Dead 2.
I mean, what a beautiful summation, and a perfect place to end our just dance with Evil Dead 2, up here in the tower in the flames, just dancing with all the deadites up here. This has been such a joy to really dive in with you, Joe. Thank you so much for taking the time. And I hope everybody rewatches this film with kind of all that we've talked about in mind. You're so inviting and welcoming and excited. I share in your excitement, and I'm just so glad I got to talk to you about this wonderful film today. Thank you so much for joining.
No, any chance that I get to talk to you, or, you know, or any filmmaker, but specifically you, since the last couple of years we've become mutual appreciators of each other's work, and we become friends, and, you know, you don't get, this is a very isolating industry sometimes, like, where you always see people on Instagram, like, oh, they're hanging out with all my buddies, but it can still be somewhat lonely, you know? So any chance that I can get, or, you know, Becca and I can get to be able to talk to lovely folks like you and feel like we're all geeking out on the same thing is always a treat. Thank you. You gave me an excuse to watch Evil Dead 2 for the umpteenth time. It doesn't take much. It could be like, oh, you know, the wind's blowing in a certain way. Well, it sounds like Evil Dead 2's wind. You know what? I guess I'm going to have to watch Evil Dead 2. And you know what? I would recommend, if anything, maybe have me and this, I'm not just saying it's like, oh, it's my wife, but when you get the two of us in a room together to talk about movies like this, It's a lot of fun because, again, we started a YouTube show now. It's going to be on YouTube called A Couple of Old Fashions. And essentially the shameless plug is, she and I, who have wildly different tastes, but a lot of the same tastes, we pick a movie based on the same theme. We don't tell each other what the movie is. We bring them both to the table and we go, okay, you know, it's like, could this be a good double feature? We watch it and then we discuss it. And it usually goes off on wild tangents. But again, there's nothing better when you're a movie fan to listen to other movie fans talk about their mutual appreciation for movies. And we watch a lot of movies. So If you ever need a double date experience, we get Justin, you know, on too, and we can do a quadruple date kind of situation.
For Valentine's Day.
Perfect. Okay.
Yes.
I'm laying the gauntlet down now. Valentine's Day episode. Let's do it.
That's listeners, that's my producer, Jordan. And I totally agree with you, Jordan. Valentine's Day would be like a perfect time. We have the same dynamic as you guys. And Joe, my birthday is Valentine's Day.
Oh my God, even
better.
So
that'd be perfect.
Well, let us, I don't want to, you know, kind of push our wares onto you guys, but allow us to be able to celebrate your birthday in the best way possible by doing a podcast together.
I mean, what better way of geeking out with friends and talking about movies? That's the best birthday ever.
I love it. I'm in.
Amazing. Well, thank you so much, Joe.
Oh my God, my pleasure. Thank you, guys.
The Tower is a Glass Eye Picks production. The show is created and hosted by me, Emily Bennett. The show is produced by Jordan Goss-Pure. Technical advisor is Justin Brooks. Sound engineering by Mark Bush. Original music for The Tower was composed by Graham Resnick. Additional music provided by Epidemic Sound. Art by Steak Mountain. See you next time.
The Bleacher Report app is your destination for sports. Right now, the NBA is heating up, March Madness is here, and MLB is almost back. Every day there's a new headline, a new highlight, a new moment you've got to see for yourself. That's why I stay locked in with the Bleacher Report app. For me, it's about staying connected to my sports. I can follow the teams I care about, get real-time scores, breaking news, and highlights all in one place. Download the Bleacher Report app today so you never miss a moment.